the grocers, I met an old friend who had continued his life as it had begun in the avant-garde, but not selfishly. He had also organized guerrilla theater demonstrations and had never spoken ill of the people. Most artists do because they have very small audiences and are angry at those audiences for not enlarging themselves. How can they do that, I've often asked. They have word of mouth, don't they? Most artists peevishly will reply. Well, first my friend and I talked of the lettuce boycott. It was an old boycott. I told my friend, whose name was Jim, all about the silk stocking boycott, which coincided with the Japanese devastation of Manchuria and the disappearance of the 6th Avenue L into Japanese factory furnaces, to be returned a few years later, sometimes to the very same neighborhood as shrapnel stuck in the bodies of some young men of my generation. Did that lead to Pearl Harbor, he asked respectfully. He was aware that I had witnessing information of events that had occurred when he was in grade school. That respect gave me all the advantage I needed to be aggressive and critical. I said, Jim, I've been wanting to tell you I do not believe in the effectiveness of the way you had the Vietnamese screaming at our last demonstration. I don't think the meaning of our struggle has anything to do with all that racket. You don't understand our tone, he said. I believe that the theater is the handmaiden of the revolution. The valet, you mean. He deferred to my correction by nodding his head. He accepts criticism gracefully, since he can always meet it with a smiling bumper of iron opinion. You ought to know more about Artaud, he said. You're right, I should, but I've been awfully busy. Also, I may have once known a great deal about him. In the last few years, all the characters of literature run together in my head. Sometimes King Ubu appears right next to Mr. Sparset. At this point, the butcher said, what do you have, young lady? I refused to tell him. Jack, to whom, if you remember, I was telling this day-long story, muttered, oh, God, no, you didn't do that again. I did, I said. It's an insult. You do not say to a woman of my age who looks my age, what do you have, young lady? I did not answer him. If you say that to someone like me, it really means, what do you want, you pathetic old hag? Are you getting like that now, too, he asked. Look, Jack, face facts. Let's say the butcher meant no harm. Eddie, he's not so bad. He spends 2 hours coming to New York from Jersey, then he spends 2 hours going back. I'm sorry for his long journey, but I still mean it. He mustn't say that anymore. Eddie, I said, don't talk like that or I won't tell you what I want. Whatever you say, honey, what do you have? Well, could you cut me up a couple of fryers? Sure, I will, he said. I'll have a pork butt, said Jim. By the way, you know, we're doing a show at the City College this summer. Not in the auditorium, in the biology lab. It's a new idea. We had to fight for it. It's the most political thing we've done since scavenging. Did I hear you say City College, asked Eddie, as he cut the little chicken's leg out of its socket? Well, when I was a boy, a kid, what we called City College then, you know, it was CCNY then. Well, we called it Circumcised Citizens of New York. Really, said Jim. He looked at me. Did I object? Was I offended? The fact of male circumcision doesn't insult me, I said. However, the clipping of clitorises of young girls continues in Morocco to this day. Jim has a shy side. He took his pork butt and said goodbye. I have begun to examine the chicken livers. Sometimes they are tanner than red, but I understand this is not too bad. Suddenly, Treadwell Thomas appeared at my side and embraced me. He's a famous fussy gourmet, and I was glad that the butcher saw our affectionate hug. Thought up any good euphemisms lately, I asked. Ha ha, he said. He still feels bad about his life in the language division of the Defense Department. A year ago, Jack interviewed him for a magazine called The Social Ordure, which ran 5 quarterly issues before the editor was hired away by the Times. Here's part of the interview. Mr. Thomas, what is the purpose of the language division? Well, Jack, it was organized to discontinue the English language as a useful way to communicate exact facts. Of course, it's not the first or last organization to have attempted this, but it's had some success. Mr. Thomas, is this an ironic statement made in the afterglow of your new idealism and the broad range of classified information it has made available to us? Not at all, Jack. It wasn't I who invented the expression protective reaction. And it was Eisenhower, not I, who thought of, while thousands of hydrogen bombs were being tucked into silos and submarines, was not I who invented Atoms for Peace and its code name, Operation Wheaties. Could you give us at least one expression you invented to stultify or mitigate? Jack, I screamed, stultify or mitigate, you caught the disease. Shut up, said Jack, and returned to the interview. Well, he asked. Well, said Treadwell Thomas, I was asked to develop a word or series of words that could describe but denote any of the Latin American countries in a condition of change, something that would, by its mere utterance, neutralize or mock their revolutionary situation. After consultation, brain picking, and the daydreaming that is appropriate to any act of creation, I came up with Revostate. This word was slipped into conversations in Washington. One or two journalists were glad to use it. It was just lingo for a long time. But you have no doubt seen the monograph, The Revostationary Peasant in Brazil Today. Even you Pinkos use it, not to mention Wasserman's poetic article, Rainforest, Still Water, and the Culture of the Revostate, which was actually featured in this journal. Right on, Treadwell, as our black brothers joyfully said for a couple of years before handing that utterance on for our stultification or mitigation. Still, it's true, Thomas could have gone as far happens to be in our time and generation. Hundreds of ambitious, jobless college students at the foot of his tongue on senior Defense Department recruiting day. But apart from cooking a lot of fish, he has chosen to guffaw quite often. Some people around here think that guffawing and the energetic cleansing of the nasal passage is the basic wisdom of the East. Other people think that's not true. Which reminded me, how's Gussie? Gus? Oh, yeah, she's into hydroponics. She's got all this stuff standing around in tubs. Women never have to go shopping again. Well, I laughed and laughed. I repeated the story to several others before the day was over. I mocked Gussie to Jack. I spoke of her mockingly to one or two strangers. And the fact is, she was already the wave of the future. I was ignorant. It wasn't my ocean she was a wave on. In fact, I am stuck here among my own ripples and tides. Don't you wish you could rise powerfully above your time and name? I'm sure we all try, but here we are, always slipping and falling down into them, speaking their narrow language, though the subject, which is how to save the world and quickly, is immense. Goodbye, Treadwell, I said sadly. I've got to get some greens. The owner of our grocery was hosing down the vegetables. He made the lettuce look fresher than it was. Little drops of water stood on the broccoli heads among the green, beady buds and were just the same size. Orlando, I said, Jack was walking the dog last night at 2 a.m. and I was out at 7 a.m. and you were here both times. That's true, I was. Orlando, how can you do that? How can you get to work? How can you live? How can you see your kids and your wife? I can't, he said, maybe once a week. Are you all right? Yes. He put down his hose and took my hand in his. You see, he said, this is wonderful work. This is food. I love all work that has to do with food. I'm lucky. He dropped my hand and patted a red cabbage. Look at me. I'm a small businessman. I got an A&P on one side, a Bohack on another, and a fancy international full of cheese and herring down the block. If I don't put in 16 hours a day, I'm dead. But Mrs. A, look at that rack, the beans, that corner with the parsley and the arugula and the dill. It's beautiful, right? Oh, yes, I said. I guess it is. But what I really love are the little bunches of watercress, the way you've lined the carrot bin with them. Yeah, you're okay. You got the idea, the beauty, he said, and went off to take three inferior strawberries out of a perfect box. A couple of years later, in the present, which I have not quite mentioned, but will, we fought over Chilean plums. We parted. I was forced to shop in the reasonable supermarket among disinterested people with no credit asked and none offered. But at that particular moment, we were at peace. That is, I owed him $275, and he allowed it. Okay, said Jack. If you and Orlando are such pals, why aren't all these strawberries ripe? He picked up a rather green, eroded one. I offered an anthropological reply. Well, Orlando's father is an old man. One of the jobs Orlando's culture has provided for his father's old age is the sorting of strawberries into pint and quart boxes. Just to be fair, he has to hide one or two greenish ones in each box. I think I'll go to bed, said Jack. I was only extrapolating from his article in the final issue of the Social Ordure, Food Merchandising, or Who Invented the Greedy Consumer? I reminded him of this. He said politely, ah. The day had been too long, and I hadn't said one word about the new young fathers or my meeting with Zagrebsky, the pharmacist. I thought we might discuss them at breakfast. So he slept, his arms around me as sweetly as after the long day. He had probably slept beside his former wife, and I as well, beside my et cetera, et cetera. I was so comfortable. Our good mattress and nice feelings were such a cozy combination that I remembered a song my friend Ruthie had made up 10 years earlier to tease the time, the place, us. Oh, the marriage bed, can you think of anything nicer? For days and nights of years and years, you lie beside your darling. Your arms are hugging one another, your legs are twined together, until the dark and certain day your lover comes to take you away, away, away. At about 3 a.m., Jack cried out in terror. That's okay, kid, I said. You're not the only one. Everybody's mortal. I leaned my strength against his back. Then I dreamed the following in a kind of diorama of technicolor abstraction, that the children had grown all the way up. One had moved to another neighborhood, the other to a distant country. That one was never to be seen again, the dream explained, because he had blown up a very bad bank, and in the dream I was the one who told him to do it. The dream continued. No, it circled itself, widening into my old age. Then his disappearance made one of those typical spiraling descents influenced by film technique. Unreachable at the bottom, their childhood played war and made jokes. I woke. Where's the glass of water? I screamed. I want to tell you something, Jack. What? What? He sat up. What? Jack, I want to have a baby. Ha ha, he said. You can't. Too late. A couple of years too late, he said, and fell asleep. Then he spoke. Besides, suppose it worked. I mean, suppose a miracle. The kid might be very smart, get a scholarship to MIT, get caught up in problem solving. God almighty, it could invent something worse than anything us old dodos ever imagined. Then he fell asleep and snored. I pulled the Old Testament out from under the bed where I keep most of my bedtime literature. I jammed an extra pillow under my neck and sat up almost straight in order to read the story of Abraham and Sarah with interlinear intelligence. There was a lot in what Jack said. He often makes a sensible, a thought-provoking remark. Because you know how that old story ends. Well, with those three monotheistic horsemen of perpetual bossdom and war, Christianity, Judaism, and Islam. Just the same, I said to softly snoring Jack, before all that popular badness wedged its way into the world, there was first the little baby, Isaac. You know what I mean. Looking at Sarah, just like all our own old babies. Remember the way they worked up their five little senses? Oh, Jack, that Isaac, Sarah's boy, before he was old enough to be taken out by his father to get his throat cut, he must have just lain around smiling and making up diphthongs and listening, and the women sang songs to him and wrapped him up in such pretty rugs, right? In his sleep, which is as contentious as his waking, Jack said, yes, but he should not have been allowed to throw all that sand at his brother. You're right. You're right. I'm with you there, I said. Now, all you have to do is be with me. I'm going to read you one very short little story. This is from my mother. And it's also from my friend Ruth here that I just met that I haven't seen since I was, I don't know, very small. Okay. One day I was listening to the AM radio and I heard a song. Oh, I longed to see my mother in the doorway. By God, I said, I understand that song. I have often longed to see my mother in the doorway. As a matter of fact, she did stand frequently in various doorways looking at me. She stood one day just so in the front door, the darkness of the hallway behind her. It was New Year's Day. She said sadly, if you come home at 4 a.m. when you're 17, what time will you come home when you're 20? She asked this question without humor and without meanness. She had begun her worried preparations for death. She would not be present, she knew, when I was 20, so she wondered. Another time she stood in the doorway of my room. I had just issued a political manifesto attacking the family's position on the Soviet Union. She said, go to sleep for God's sakes, you damn fool, you and your communist ideas. We saw them already, Papa and me, in 1905. We guessed it all. At the door of the kitchen, she said, you never finish your lunch. You run around senselessly. What will become of you? Then she died. Naturally, for the rest of my life, I longed to see her, not only in doorways, in a great number of places, in the dining room with my aunts, at the window looking up and down the block, in the country garden among zinnias and marigolds, in the living room with my father. They sat in comfortable leather chairs. They were listening to Mozart. They looked at one another, amazed. It seemed to them they'd just come over on the boat. They had just learned the first English words. It seemed to them that he had just proudly handed in a 100% correct exam to the American anatomy professor. It seemed as though she had just quit the shop for the kitchen. I wish I could see her in the doorway of the living room. She stood there a minute. Then she sat beside him. They owned an expensive record player. They were listening to Bach. She said to him, talk to me a little. We don't talk so much anymore. I'm tired, he said. Can't you see? I saw maybe 30 people today, all sick, all talk, 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 talk. Listen to the music, he said. I believe you once had perfect pitch. I'm tired, he said. Then she died. I'm just going to read a short story, a short, short story. And, this one is called The Northeast Playground. Seems about the right size. It's a story about going back someplace after a number of years, but it was also, I have to say, it was written, maybe 10 years ago. Okay. When I went to the playground in the afternoon, I met 11 unwed mothers on relief. Only four of them were whores. The rest of them were unwed on principle or because some creep had ditched them. The babies were all under 1 year old, very funny and lovable. When the mothers stuck them in the sandbox, they took up the whole little desert, throwing sand and screeching. A kid with a father at home, acknowledging and willing to support, couldn't get a wet toehold. How come you're all here, I asked. By accident, said the first. A couple of us happened to meet, said the second, liked one another and introduced friends. Well, like a special interest group, said a third. That was Janice, a political woman conscious of power structure and power itself. A fourth came into the playground with 11 Dixie cups, chocolate and vanilla. She passed them around. What a wonderful, calm unity in this group. When I was a mother of babies in this same park, we were not so unified and often quarreled, accusing other children of unhealthy aggression or excessive timidity. He's a ruined wreck, we'd say about some streaky squeaker about 2 years old. No hope. His eyelids droop. Look how he hangs on to his little armored pair. Of course, said Janice, if you want to see a beauty, there's Claude, Lenny's baby. The doll, said Janice, who had a perfectly good baby of her own in a sling across her chest, asleep in the heat of her protection. Claude was beautiful. He was bouncing on Lenny's lap. He was dark brown, though she was white. Beautiful, I said. Lenny is very unusual, said Janice. She's from Brighton Beach, a street whore despite her age, weight, and religion. He's not my baby, said Lenny. Some dude owed me and couldn't pay, so he gave me the first little bastard he had. Honey, I just stay home now like a mama bear and look at TV. I don't turn a trick a week. He takes all my time, my Claudie. Don't you, you little pancake. Eat your ice cream, Claude. The sun's douching it away. The sixth and seventh unwed mothers were twin sisters who had always dressed alike. The eighth and ninth were whores and junkies and watched each other's babies when working or flying. There were very handsome women with other 4 and 5 year old children in the child care center, and their baby girls sat in ribbons and white voile in the fine high veneer and chrome imported carriages. They never let the kids play in the sand. They were disgusted to see them get dirty or wet and gave them hell when they did. The girls who were unwed on principle, that included Janice and the twins, considered it rigidity but not hopeless because of the extenuating environment. The 10th and 11th appeared depressed. They had been ditched, and it kept them from total enjoyment of the babies, though they clutched the little butterballs to their hearts or flew into the sandbox at the call of a whimper, hollering, what, who took your shovel? Claude, Lenny, Claude. He's a real boy, said Lenny. These two did not like to be on welfare at all. They were embarrassed, but not to the point of rudeness to their friends, who weren't. Still, every now and then, they'd make ironic remarks. They were young and very pretty, the way almost all young girls tend to be these days, and would probably never be ditched again. I tried to tell them this, and they replied, thanks. One ironic remark they'd make was, my mother says, don't feel bad, Allison's a love child. The mother was accepting and advanced, but poor. The afternoon I visited, I asked one or two simple questions and made a statement. I asked, wouldn't it be better if you mixed in with the other mothers and babies who are really a friendly bunch? They said no. I asked, what do you think this ghettoization will do to your children? They smiled proudly. Then I stated, in a way, it was like this when my children were little babies. The ladies who once wore I Like Ike buttons sat on the south side of the sandbox, and the rest of us who were revisionist communist and revisionist Trotskyite and revisionist Zionist registered Democrats sat on the north side. In response to my statement, no kidding, most of them said. Beat it, said Janice.
Pioneering audience, you're a great audience. I would like to thank Grace Bailey for that really poetic, ironic, funny reading. Thank you for coming. And one last thing, I'd like to remind you about the May 17th reading with Audre Lorde. Thank you.
Thank you for joining us on Women's Studies. You've been listening to another in a series of readings sponsored by 13th Moon. Today's readers were Marilyn Hacker and Grace Bailey. I'm Viv Sutherland.
Of every man who put me here. Shout.